House Committee on Judiciary come to order. Today is April 4th, 2017. The first item on the agenda today we're going to go out of order will be House Bill 3392 and call Representative Peluso, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3392 prohibits a person's blindness as serving as a basis for the denial or restriction of custody or parenting time, participation in adoption proceedings, opportunity to provide foster care, or ability to serve as guardian. Requires an opposing party in a domestic relations or juvenile dependency proceeding to prove by clear and convincing evidence that blindness is likely to endanger the child. Requires a court to adopt specified findings when the court denies or limits certain rights related to custody, parenting time, foster care, guardianship, or adoption. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative.
Good afternoon, Chair Barker and fellow members of the House Judiciary Committee. For the record, my name is Carla Peluso, State Representative for House District 50, the great city of Gresham, and a little sliver of Southeast Portland. I am here today to ask for your support of House Bill 3392. This bill works to eliminate discrimination against blind parents, prospective parents, or caretakers of children in domestic relations cases and juvenile dependency proceedings. The concept for this bill was brought to me by one of my constituents, Tracy Boyd, who you will be hearing from in a bit. Tracy is a loving mother of her four children and a leader in her community. She is president of the Oregon Parents Division of the National Federation of the Blind, which works to support blind parents and advocate for the rights of the blind community. Tracy brought to my attention the discrimination many blind parents face when they have become involved in our judicial systems. Parents and caregivers who are blind face unfair, preconceived societal biases that have led to unnecessary removal of children from their care. House Bill 3392 creates policies that prevent this kind of discrimination from destroying families. All potential foster, adoptive, and biological parents should have the opportunity to provide a loving and nurturing environment for their children without the fear of their blindness being used as a tool against them. I care deeply for the well-being of our children. I believe that House Bill 3392 will only strengthen Oregon's families, allowing more families to stay together and more devoted caregivers to provide Oregon's children as loving caregivers, foster families, and parents. This bill works to create more equity in our judicial system. I urge your support for House Bill 3392.
Thank you. Any questions for Representative Peluso?
Can I ask a question?
Yes, you can.
Perhaps of counsel. The section one of this bill has a set of findings, some of which are relatively subjective. What's the standing of the findings that the legislature makes in terms of a bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, I don't know that I would characterize them as having the force of law, but I think if a court were interpreting the substantive provisions, they would look to the findings to guide them. If there was any ambiguity, they would err on the side that was consistent with the findings.
Then is there a standard that we need to meet in terms of evidence or any evidentiary basis? I mean, it talks about antiquated attitudes. That's an interesting statement.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, I suspect in the vast majority of instances, a court's going to defer to the wisdom of the legislative assembly and not require evidence. There may be sort of a narrow, narrow subset of circumstances where a court would look behind the findings.
I was asking whether we as a legislature need to have evidence to support findings that are put forth in a section of a bill.
Let me just make them up.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Greenlick, I think generally you should have some evidence to rely on, but I don't think anyone, a court in particular, is going to ask you to demonstrate what that evidence is. I mean, I think it's largely a legislative determination whether or not the existing evidence is sufficient.
So we should weigh, in terms of the Section 1, whether there's evidence to support this, the findings that are in the bill as a part of our legislative duty.
I think that's a fair statement.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
If I might, I think you'll be hearing from Aaron Knott a little later in that might answer your question.
I always like hearing from him.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
I call John Gardner, Kristen Jokums, and Carla McQuillan.
I'm sitting on the left.
Okay.
Oh, I'm in the middle.
And you can go in any order, but please remember to state your name for the record when you start speaking. Thank you.
Do you want me to go first?
Sure. My name is Carla McQuillan. I am the president of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon and the executive director of Main Street Montessori Association. I oversee the operation of Montessori preschool and child care centers in Lane County. And I come to speak wearing both hats today, that I was going through and calculating. In my 28 years working in the field of child care here in Oregon, I have personally been involved in 12 cases where the state Child Protective Services Agency was brought in because of abuse, neglect, what have you. Only one out of those 12 was not related to physical, sexual abuses or drug and alcohol addiction, and the one that was not was neglect. And this was we had a 1 and 2 year old in our program who frequently would come in, sometimes obviously days without bathing, without changing of diapers. One time in particular, remember, was like Monday after a Thanksgiving 4-day weekend. And in that case, the children were never removed from the home. The family was monitored and provided with education. Conversely, I have dealt with in Oregon 6 cases where there was intervention from Child Protective Services with blind parents. 2 of those were with brand new babies and born in a hospital where the hospital did not want to release them strictly because their parents were blind. I dealt with 2 cases where the children were removed from the home without any justification other than the parents were blind. And 2 cases that were related to custody, one with regard to a divorce situation and one for a grandmother who wanted custody, primary custody of a grandchild whose mom was drug addicted. And in all of those cases, there was no evidence presented that any form of real abuse was involved on the part of the blind individual, and yet denial, termination of parental rights, and removal of children from the home happened in all of those 6 cases. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My name is Kristen Jokums. I am a family law mediator, a parent coordinator. I also litigated for 9 years in family law matters in another jurisdiction. I am a divorced mother of 2, a 13-year-old and an 11-year-old. I am here today to support this bill based from a personal perspective as well as a professional perspective. When I got divorced, we had a custody evaluator involved in our case. My former husband had an anger management issue. The custody evaluator was to investigate this matter. However, unfortunately, the custody evaluator spent very little time on that matter and was ill-equipped to deal with the fact that my former husband brought up the issues of blindness as a hindrance to me being a good mom. Because of that, we spent 3 years in litigation, $60,000 in attorney's fees, to overcome very insignificant matters which he brought up as basis for trying to deny me custody of the children. Also, unfortunately, this custody evaluator made a recommendation which gave him 46% of parenting time, which was an unworkable situation. We had to go back and modify that arrangement several years later, spent an additional $80,000 and 2 more years in heart-wrenching litigation. So I am here to ask, not only on behalf of blind parents who are faced with a very intractable situation in the courts, but also to ask you to help the professionals that are involved in custody matters and in DHS cases, to give them a standard which is reliable for them to evaluate parents. Clear and convincing evidence is a key to making sure that some decision makers hidden biases are not going to be influencing the decisions that they make to, recommend to a court or make as judges in these cases. So again, thank you for letting me talk here today. I really appreciate your time and hope that you will support this bill.
Thank you.
My name is John Gardner. I'm from Corvallis. I am a professor emeritus of physics from Oregon State University. I'm founder and president of ViewPlus Technologies, which is a multi-million dollar company that markets access technologies, making it possible for blind people around the world to have much better access to information. I lost my sight in mid-career, so I did not personally raise children as a blind person. I've changed a few diapers as a blind grandparent, but still the primary custody of the grandchildren is not mine. So I'm not testifying from my personal experience, except that I have sat through many seminars listening to some of the most heartrending statements that I've ever heard from blind parents who were denied custody of their children for no reason except that they were blind. And many of them, not just for days or even weeks, but some of them for years. And in the end, they got their children back when the courts found for them that they had been inappropriately denied custody of their children. But you can't take a year or two out of a child's life and a parent's life without doing unending damage. So this kind of law is absolutely essential. It is needed to ensure that justice is done and that the biases, intentional or otherwise, on the part of sighted people who can't really comprehend the fact that blind people can lead normal lives allows them to conclude that there must be some reason that a blind parent can't be a good parent. That just isn't true. I've known many, many wonderful blind parents, including Kristen, whose children are very well adjusted, very happy children. And I think that she is a really excellent parent, but she's not the only one. I've known blind parents actually in three or four continents. And it is certainly possible to be a really good parent and be blind. But we need a law that makes it clear that blindness by itself is not a reason to assume that a parent can't be a good parent. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions, this panel? Thank you very much for your testimony, panel.
You're welcome.
Next, I'll call Tina Hansen, Kendra Schraber, and Tracy Boyd. Speaking in your order, just be sure to identify yourself by name when you start talking.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Tina Hansen. I live right here in Salem in House District 22, and I am a concerned individual who is speaking in support of this bill. I have not had any personal experience with this myself, since I'm not a parent, but I really believe that this bill promotes common sense, because I have myself seen blind and visually impaired parents. You know, I don't believe you have to be blind in order to have compassion or, you know, have feelings and care for children. You really don't have, I really believe that you can be blind and still care for children. You don't have to be sighted in order to have compassion and to have feelings. I have compassion for others, and you know, as a blind person, I can feel others' understanding and compassion because I care about them. I know I have a friend who's fighting to get her own grandchildren back out of the system, a couple of twins that she's adopted. It has nothing to do with blindness. The kids have been abused and neglected, but I feel for my friend, and I probably would feel the same way if I could see it, but blindness for me does not stop someone from having compassion on for others. So that's why I really believe this bill is a promotion of common sense that says, hey, a blind person can be a parent. A blind person can care for children. I've witnessed it. So I just really hope that this bill, I just really encourage you guys to pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you.
Sorry about some of my wording there.
It's okay. You did fine.
That's okay. Is the mic?
Yes. Yeah, please.
Okay. There it is. All right. I'm Kendra Schauber, and I live right here in Salem. And I, too, am, you know, I'm not a parent, so I've never experienced this firsthand. I'm not a professional, so I'm in this field, so I've never experienced it from that angle. Although I am an aunt, I have changed a few diapers and fed my nieces and nephew a few times, so I can honestly say that I've had that experience. But on the other hand, I do support this bill, and I believe that you don't have to be able to see to raise a kid any more than you would to raise a puppy or a cat, you know? And the problem with the law today is that it basically says it's okay to discriminate against blindness, and with this bill, it basically says that it isn't, as well as it shouldn't be. So I agree with Tina in the sense that it is supporting common sense, so I ask that you pass it.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome, and thank you for giving me the time to speak.
Very nice.
Thanks. Go ahead.
Good afternoon. My name is Tracy Boyd, and I come for you today from Gresham, District 50, and I am imploring you to pass this bill. I am a parent to four beautiful, healthy, wonderful children, ranging in age from 22, 15, 11, and 4. Mm-hmm. My kids are as well-adjusted, as happy, as sighted individuals' children, mm-hmm. and I am asking you to recognize that today, right now, blind people are having their children removed from their homes, having their parental rights taken away from them solely based on the fact that they are blind. This characteristic does not hinder parenting in any way, shape, or form. 13% of disabled parents have their children in some way taken from the home or their parenting rights taken from them, whereas non-disabled parents, it is only 0.05% of those parents in the cases where removal or rights are taken. So this is a 26 times more likely in the case of a disabled parent that there will be some sort of intervention from the court removing that viable parent and that disrupting that attachment that happens throughout life between parent and child. And I'm asking you to recognize the severity of what is happening right now, today, in Oregon. I am a mentor. I'm the president of the Parents Division of Oregon for the National Federation of the Blind, and right now I am mentoring a blind young woman who had her child taken away from her at just a couple months old. Currently, the child is 2 years old. It is an ugly case that is in litigation, and her parenting has been questioned over various things that have all been founded to be untrue. She still only has supervised visitation with her daughter, which breaks my heart. And I want you to support this bill put it through and make sure that this doesn't happen in Oregon any longer. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from the panel? Thank you very much for your testimony. The paperwork has not caught up yet, but we intend to, or I intend to, try to move this to a work session once we get the paperwork caught up.
Thank you.
And Aaron Knott, please.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for giving us the opportunity to speak.
Well, thank you for coming down. We appreciate your testimony.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Aaron Knott. I'm the legislative director for the Oregon Attorney General at the Department of Justice. We're neutral on House Bill 3392, though we think the underlying policy, which is preventing discrimination against the blind or visually impaired in parenting, is extremely important. I am here at the request of the sponsor, Representative Peluso. The Department of Justice contacted her recently because we had identified a point that we thought needed a little bit of additional work in this bill. Section 2 creates a different process for individuals suffering from blindness than for anyone else. There's a different applicable standard, clear and convincing, needs to be shown. And our concern is that this could run afoul of the equal protection provision of the Constitution. Basically, it takes blindness and creates a separate path than it would create for any other form of physical limitation, diminished mobility, deafness, all things that you could see potentially being implicated in the same way that you've heard this testimony of discrimination against the blind. I don't have any testimony about the experience of what's happening with DHS. Or anything like that. This is just a purely facial legal analysis, and we are happy to work with the proponent and legislative council to see if we can find a way out of it.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Weil.
Aaron, I'm glad you came, and I had exactly the same question when I read the bill. Would it be possible to include an exhaustive list of the categories of people that might be affected and maybe solve the problem that way, or is that impossible to come up with that list?
Chair Barker, Representative Weil, I think that's what the Equal Protection Clause actually endeavors to do, is to put that in the Constitution, make sure that it's a bedrock principle of our social governance and no one is discriminated against. The Equal Protection Clause does sweep in not just the plain language of the clause, but all of the case law in every area that's come behind it. So I think statutorily that could be a challenge. I think that is going to be the question we try to look at here in the next few days.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman?
Follow up, please.
I almost asked Kristen this, and maybe I should have. The practice of law tends to be a little bit complex when we begin looking at affirmative defenses and the clear and convincing standard versus a variety of other standards. What would this, let's assume that this were okay, what would it do to really change current law? Would that affirmative defense be the thing that's different?
Chair Barker, Representative Weil, requiring a different standard, clear and convincing is a different evidentiary showing, as you know, that you would need to get to. So I think this is really a question for DHS at a certain point to find out what their administrative rules are, what standards they're applying, how they're applying them in the field. I think as a theoretical matter, yes, clear and convincing is a higher evidentiary standard on that point. But in terms of how it would actually play out on the ground, I am the wrong person to tell you.
Well, the thing about Kristen's story that kind of got me was the fact that it came up in the context of a domestic dispute and a custody fight. And because I think the DHS example is an important example as well, but I'm anxious that if we do try and solve this problem, we don't create a bigger problem that courts are going to have to wrestle with in terms of the Equal Protection Clause. And I would just encourage all the parties to do what they can. I like the idea. I certainly support the concept, but I would hate to see us come through this and have something that isn't going to stand up when the fight actually happens.
Right.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you,
Mr.
Chairman. Any other questions? Representative Greenlight.
Aaron, you may have heard my concern for the question of finding. Do we have some obligation to back up those findings before we adopt them?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlich, if by that do you mean do you have to introduce a specific factual record into the evidence before you make a legislative finding, I think the answer is no.
Should we have some evidence to consider before we make the finding?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlich, just speaking procedurally in terms of whether or not it's a requirement, which is, I think, is the only level I can speak, I don't think there's a requirement that that be done. Whether legislators require that as part of their process of deliberating on a particular legislative proposal is, of course, up to the legislator.
Can I follow on?
Yes, please.
The issue that I think Representative Vile was raising, could Section 2 be summarized into saying a person should not be disqualified to be a parent simply on the basis of blindness? Is that the summary of Section 2?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlich, that's, I think, at the highest level of remove, that is the basic function of Section 2. But Section 2 does go further than that. It also outlines the need to require specific supportive parenting services. There are specific findings that the court has to make. And I suppose you could boil that down a bit. The way it's written now, it all falls under the umbrella you just articulated, but there are different planks for how that plays out in terms of what accommodation is made and what the court specifically has to rule on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you, Representative.
Sorry, follow up. The thing that I think Representative Greenlich getting at is, if we just took paragraph 3, 2 sub 3, is that?
Right.
2 sub 3. A prospective parent's blindness may not serve as a basis for the parent's denial of participation in public or private adoption proceedings. If we, and 4, to be appointed guardian. In other words, if we just said that and we didn't have the affirmative defense and the clear and convincing evidence standards, would that be enough to protect the blind parents? And I'm assuming that from what I heard from Kristen a minute ago, the answer to that is probably no, that we're concerned that we need a higher burden than that. And I think I'm convinced that we probably do. We probably should get a higher burden, but maybe for a whole bunch more folks.
Okay, thank you. Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3392 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2238.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2238, as introduced, classifies possession of a controlled substance as a misdemeanor in certain circumstances. It establishes a task force on public safety. The bill also directs the Criminal Justice Commission and Department of Human Services to prepare racial and ethnic impact statements on proposed legislation and ballot measures related to crime and human services, respectively. There is a -1 amendment before you. The -1 amendment removes entirely the provisions related to the possession of a controlled substance. The -1 amendment modifies the process applicable to racial and ethnic impact statements by requiring a written request from a member of each major political party on legislation or a ballot measure that is related to crime and likely to have an effect on the criminal justice system. Finally, the -1 amendment repeals the Task Force on Public Safety in 2023. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, my name is Mike Schmidt. I'm the Executive Director of the Criminal Justice Commission. And here before you to testify on the -1 amendment to House Bill 2238 in support. The -1 amendment essentially does two things, what is remaining in the bill, which is reestablishes the Public Safety Task Force. The Public Safety Task Force was first authorized in 2013 out of House Bill 3194. That sunset at the beginning of this year, and that was the body that was really overseeing the implementation of the Justice Reinvestment Act. It was one of the recommendations of that body when they wrote a report to the legislature that they be reauthorized, but of course they did elapse. So this would bring that back, although of course the governor would have to appoint new members, as well as the speaker and the Senate president would have to appoint new members, so they'd be different people, but it would bring back the same body. And they would continue to oversee implementation of justice reinvestment, which is a program that continues to go on. And also, this bill would add a couple more things to their purview. One of those would be looking at our pretrial system, especially as it pertains to race and ethnicity and how that plays into our criminal justice system. And then they would also be in charge of, let's see, it was one other thing. I lost it. Well, oh, and fines and fees. Looking at criminal fines and fees was the other thing that the task force would then be looking at and how that plays out in our system. So this bill, as Council Nasby pointed out, would reauthorize the Public Safety Task Force, and they would go until 2023. And they would write a report and submit it to the legislature. The other thing that this bill does is it removes the sunset on the racial and ethnic impact statements. That was a bill that I believe passed in 2015, and it sunsets on January 1st, 2018. So this would remove that sunset, so they would continue to exist. The Criminal Justice Commission is the agency that is in charge of doing the ethnic and racial impact statements. So the other two things that this bill does is, although it removes the sunset, the way that the statute is currently written, the Criminal Justice Commission can be asked to do a racial and ethnic impact statement on anything that impacts the criminal justice system. This is problematic for us. We are a criminal justice agency, and so there are many things that may have impacts on the criminal justice system, and I'll give you an example. This summer, there was a ballot measure to fund vocational programs in schools. And the proponents of this ballot measure reached out to the Criminal Justice Commission and began the conversation of wanting to request us to do a racial and ethnic impact statement on how funding vocational programs might affect the racial and ethnic criminal composition of the criminal justice system in Oregon at some point in the future. Now, it's an incredibly interesting study, and I'm sure there's a lot of things that could be looked at, but that is outside the ability and expertise of our agency to do that kind of a research project, especially on the timeline that's required by the statute, which is to turn something like that around in the space of 2 weeks. It's just not possible. So that's a good example of how the world is a little bit too broad. So this bill would remove the sunset, but it would say that the Criminal Justice Commission is to do these impact statements on bills or laws relating to crime, which is something that's very much within our wheelhouse and area of expertise. So it would slightly narrow the focus of the world that we would have to be asked to do this kind of assessment for. The other thing that this amendment accomplishes is there is a portion in the racial and ethnic impact statement statute currently that would have the Criminal Justice Commission doing impacts for people who receive human services. Again, this is something that is not within the expertise or the data that the Criminal Justice Commission has. And so this amendment would put that burden on the Department of Human Services to do that impact if requested. So that's what the two things that this accomplishes along with removing the sunset. So that's really, once you look at the dash one, that's what's left in 2238. This bill started out as a bill, a much broader bill, looking at PCS and other things in the system, but those concepts have been taken up in other legislation. So we no longer felt that we needed to go forward with those things in this bill.
Okay, thank you. Representative Post.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Starts on line 10 on page 1. I just want to make sure we're clear on this, because I think as of right now it says a member of the legislative, and this may have answered itself, but a member of the legislative assembly from each major political party. So I probably answered my own question, but because I was going to say, is not the Independent Party of Oregon considered a major political party now in Oregon, but they're not in the legislature, so I guess that would answer that, wouldn't it? You know what?
I agree.
I like working things out with you.
Very interesting conversation. Anything further? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
The paperwork's not ready in that bill either, so we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2238 and open a public hearing on House Bill 3056.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3056 maintains existing lien for unpaid planned community homeowners association or condominium association assessment following entry of judgment in civil action. The bill extinguishes a lien to the extent that judgment is satisfied. We do have the paperwork on the introduced version of the bill, and it is ready to go. No fiscal impact, no revenue impact.
Okay, thank you. Representative Vile, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Richard Vile, House District 26, Shoals, Sherwood, and Surrounds. I'm here today to advocate for the adoption of House Bill 3056. This is a very simple bill. It corrects a problem that we've had where judges were, we believe, confused when a partial payment on a homeowners association lien satisfied a judgment, and they've essentially taken the entire lien away at that point. I've got two colleagues here from the law firm that does most of the homeowner association collection work in the state, and I'll let them explain this, but it has no opponents. We do have some expansion of condominium lien law that we have considered. There were some amendments that were on OLIS. You can ignore those for the time being. We're just simply asking that the introduced version of the bill be adopted at this time.
Thank you. Please.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Tim Zimmerman. I am an attorney at the law firm of Vile Fotheringham LLP, and I'm here on behalf of the Community Associations Institute. I'm here to urge you to support House Bill 3056. Homeowner and condominium associations rely on assessments to fund their common expenses for their planned communities or condominiums. Unpaid assessments are a lien against the homeowner's property. If a homeowner becomes delinquent in the payment of the assessments, the association may need to seek payment through legal means, because if assessments are not paid by a homeowner, typically other homeowners within that community must make up the difference. If legal action is necessary, the association has two options: either sue for a money judgment or commence a foreclosure proceeding. The preferred method, of course, is to sue for a money judgment. Foreclosure should be the last option. Current law provides that an action to recover a money judgment for unpaid assessments may be maintained without foreclosing or waiving a lien for unpaid assessments. Recovery on the action operates to satisfy the lien or portion thereof for which recovery is made. Some believe the meaning of recovery of the action is not clear. Thus, House Bill 3056 is intended to clarify that obtaining a money judgment does not waive the association's homeowner association lien. The association lien will continue notwithstanding that the association has obtained a judgment. It further makes clear that if an association receives payment of the judgment, the amount of the lien is also reduced by the same amount. This clarification is important because if an association believes it risks losing its lien and its lien priority when it obtains a money judgment, the association is much more likely to choose a foreclosure option out of necessity. HB 3056 would make clear that associations could avoid foreclosure actions in favor of the less severe money judgment option. Therefore, we urge you support House Bill 3056. Thank you.
Chair Barker and members of the committee, my name is Ashley Yora, and I support House Bill 3056. I'm a lawyer at Vile Fotheringham LLP, and I'm also here on behalf of Community Associations Institute. For clarity, I'll refer to both condominium and homeowner associations as HOAs. House Bill 3056 clarifies that an HOA lien remains on the property for the full amount, and it is reduced by any payments received, including any payment on a judgment. To clarify, the House bill will reduce the necessity of the HOA immediately foreclosing on an HOA lien rather than trying to pursue a judgment against a delinquent owner. Many times, a member lives in the community. HOAs do not want to be forced to immediately foreclose a property to preserve their rights. However, board members, as fiduciaries, are required to take the action that will benefit the the association as a whole. HOAs cannot run without assessments to pay for items including maintenance of property, insurance, and even utilities such as water. Assessments are a necessity for associations to run. Currently, an HOA lien remains in second position behind a first mortgage and ahead of the homestead exemption. A judgment lien is a lower priority and is behind the homestead exemption. House Bill 3056 clarifies that an HOA does not have to choose to foreclose to protect its lien as to a homestead exemption or even possibly other judgments. Instead, an association can first try to collect against an owner using a judgment, which many times can be successful. Associations are communities who accept anyone who purchases a lot or unit, and they should not have to immediately foreclose owners who are delinquent to protect their lien. Rather, they should be able to first try other, often successful, means of collection. This is why I believe House Bill 3056 should be adopted in the present form.
Thank you.
I think that's all we have, Mr. Chairman. I do want to put one more thing on the record. I no longer hold an interest in Vile Fotheringham LLP, and even though I have an office there, my remuneration will in no wise be affected by this bill. So,
thank you for that.
I wanted to put that on the record.
Okay, thank you.
It's the glory of your name.
Yeah. The glory of my name. All right.
Great. Thank you very much, panel.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to do work in our work session on House Bill 3056.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3056 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 3056 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And Representative Vile, if you would carry that for us.
Be happy to. Thank you.
Okay. And now we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3057.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3057 requires a planned community homeowners association and condominium association to establish a reserve account. Creates express exemption if association not obligated to maintain property by bylaws or declaration. Specifies information to be considered in annual review of reserve accounts. Increases period of time following specified events from 180 days to 380 days. Let me try that again. From 180 days to 300 days, within which the Planned Community Homeowners Association and Condominium Association must have financial statement reviewed by an accountant. There is, however, a dash one amendment before you today. The dash one amendment eliminates the express exception to the general rule that homeowners associations must establish a reserve account and modifies components of the reserve account review by requiring assessment of the current balance and the rate of inflation for the current year. With the dash one amendments, House Bill 3057 has no revenue impact and no fiscal impact.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Richard Vile, House District 26 representative. I'm here today on behalf of the condominium working group. I should have said in the first bill, we've actually had a group of lawyers, accountants, managers, homeowner association, board members, working together for about 35 years on condominium and homeowner association bills. And the folks that are here at the table with me have been around for about twice that long doing these things. The group that we've worked with has not had much in the way of bills before the legislature over the last three or four sessions, but these are just items that are cleanup that we're working on today. So I appreciate very much your indulgence. This particular bill deals with a concept that Oregon is actually doing very well compared to many states. We require our homeowner associations to carry reserves so that they can replace their common elements. And folks aren't getting caught typically with great big special assessments at the end of a period of time to redo a roof or something like that. This bill tweaks that reserve statute in a way that would help make sure that they do it right. And I'm gonna let our accountant friends explain that a little bit more. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chair Barker, representatives, it's my pleasure today to speak in support of House
Identify
Bill.
Identify yourself first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Well, just about ready to do that.
Oh, okay. All right. Good.
That's second. My name is Dave Schwent. I'm a CPA and a reserve study provider. I've been providing services to homeowner associations and condos for close to 30 years. in terms of audits, reviews, taxes, and reserve studies. I represent today Community Associations Institute, the local chapter. CAI is a national organization that's a trade group for homeowners and condo associations throughout the United States, providing educational materials and other support. I'm also representing Oregon Washington Community Association Managers, which is a trade group for managers of homeowner associations and condos throughout Oregon and Washington. So as Rich mentioned, this bill is basically a cleanup bill. I think the statutes in Oregon are superior to a lot of states in that it requires that associations perform a reserve study and annually update that reserve study. And what's a reserve study? It's a 30-year budget that allows associations and condos and planned unit developments to determine how much they need to put away every month and every year so there's enough money in the bank to pay for future repairs and replacements of components. What's a component? It could be a roof, could be siding, windows, decks, that type of thing. So what it does is allows associations to have a basis for assessing its members so they never run out of money. And I think the bill does a good job of defining what a reserve study is and what the responsibilities are of performing a reserve study. What it doesn't do is give homeowner associations information on how to update an existing study. So after the first study was performed, the law requires that homeowner associations update that from year to year. There's confusion out there in HOA land on what constitutes an update. All this does is it gives associations more information, clarifies the statutes on what's involved in an update. And what it does is it just mentions four or five things that should be considered. Of course, the beginning balance of reserves is very important. The condition of reserves on an ongoing basis, inflation, interest earned, just those, all those indices that generally are concerned when you perform the first reserve study. So again, this bill, I look at it as just cleanup on the existing legislation, and I think it's going to help associations form a basis of what an update consists of. Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Rich Thompson with a company called Regenesis. We perform reserve studies in the Pacific Northwest. I'm here to represent the Community Associations Institute as well. I'm also the president of a national association called the Association of Professional Reserve Analysts. So I've been doing this kind of work for many years. Dave Schwent and I were instrumental in getting the initial reserve study statute in Oregon written 19 years ago. So again, this is intended to be simply a clarification to assist the boards in understanding what's necessary to keep that 30-year plan effective and as accurate as it can be, considering it's a 30-year projection. So the short list Dave mentioned, absolutely essential. We wanted to make sure it was included in the statute to give direction to the boards. So I support as well.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3057, open a work session on House Bill.
Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendment into House Bill 3057.
Representative Williamson moves the Dash 1s in House Bill 3057. Okay, are there any questions? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3057 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 3057 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, any further discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Once again, Representative Vial will be the carrier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
And so next we'll move on to open a public hearing, House Bill 3059.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 3059 extinguishes all interests in a special declarant right that is transferred by the declarant upon transfer. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, not Josh. Yeah. So we're getting pretty deep into condo land here, and I apologize for that. But here's the way this works. A declarant is simply the person or entity that declares a set of land to be subject to a declaration. Okay, that's what a declarant is. And if you remember the old English bundle of sticks, where, you know, does anybody know why we call it a deed? It's because the king was given up land and gave it to the person and walked out with a bundle of sticks and said, I give you the right to occupy, build a house. I give you the right to graze your sheep. I give you the right to cut the forest, but I don't give you the right to minerals. And so whatever bundle of sticks you got as the recipient, that act or deed of handing the bundle of sticks is where we got the idea of a deed. A declaration is a master deed. It puts on a piece of property the rights and liabilities associated with that and who's got what rights and liabilities. A declarant writes that document and often, as is allowed by statute, keeps special rights under it. Maybe the right to vote an extraordinary amount for any units that they retain, or maybe the right to add property, maybe the right to develop property that was originally going to be common property into additional units. Those are called declarant rights when they're retained, when the declarant retains that stick out of the bundle when they record the declaration. Occasionally, we've had declarants who gave up all those rights and then many years later came back and said, you know what, I bought another unit in this project, or now I own a piece of this project again. I'd like to resurrect my declarant rights and do something that ordinarily you wouldn't be able to do. That is a problem when owners have long ago thought that they were out from underneath the special declarant rights or the special powers that a declarant may have. All this bill does is make it very clear that once a declarant's given up those special rights, they're gone. You can't come back later and resurrect them by acquiring a new interest in the project somehow and then claiming, well, that was intended to cover me years down the road. We've had recent cases where we had at least one nearly $1 million lawsuit over this very issue, and this would clarify that litigation over that issue would be unnecessary and protect homeowners associations.
Chair Barker, members of the committee, my name is Greg Coxey. I'm a lawyer with Vile Fotheringham. I'm also here representing the CAI Legislative Action Committee, as well as the Oregon-Washington Community Association Managers and the Ad Hoc Condo Working Group in support of this bill. Representative Vile has described, this is a clarification on those declarant rights, where once those rights are transferred to a successor declarant, whether that be through a voluntary transfer or a situation where maybe a declarant goes into bankruptcy, that the declarant can't come back later and take those rights back. We've been operating under this assumption for years, and you know, essentially this is just a clarification of that process. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for the panel? Representative Greenlee.
Yeah, the declarant in a condo would be the person that developed it at first. Is that usually who the declarant is?
Chair Barker, Representative Greenlee, yeah, the term declarant and developer are often used interchangeably. It is essentially that person who developed, who subjects their property.
That signs
all those documents, yes, that's that person. Once again, Chair Barker, I need to put on the record, I no longer have an interest in Vile Fotheringham. This bill would not affect me in any way, shape, or form monetarily. And Greg's a constituent, so this is kind of fun because I've got a constituent here testifying as well on a bill.
Yep.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I assume if we're a member of a condo association, we don't have to declare.
I would assume that as well. You're a huge class that people are. Okay, thank you. Okay, close the public hearing on House Bill 3059. Open the work session on House Bill 3059.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 3059.
Representative Williamson moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 3059. Is there any discussion or are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 3059 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Again, any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. And former partner Vile, would you carry that bill for us?
Yes, thank you very much. And thank you, committee.
Close the work session. Open a work session on House Bill 2621.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee heard House Bill 2621 briefly on March 9th of this year. The bill modifies the crime victims compensation program administered by the Department of Justice in a number of different minor ways. There's a dash two amendment before you today. The dash two amendment modifies the manner of determining whether an applicant notified law enforcement of a crime and determining good cause for the failure to timely notify and cooperate with law enforcement. Includes the cost of certain prescription medications associated with counseling in an amount up to $1,500 for survivors of deceased victims, and authorize the Department of Justice to reimburse an applicant who incurred costs of a forensic interview conducted at a community assessment center. With the dash two amendments, there is no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash two amendments into House Bill 2621.
Representative Williamson moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2621. Discussion. Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2621 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation with the subsequent referral.
I'm sorry.
Wait, what?
My mistake. We rescinded that. Can we have a motion to rescind?
You rescinded what?
Can you have a motion to rescind the subsequent referral to Ways and Means?
Oh, sure. Can I do that right now?
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I move we remove the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Representative Williamson requests we move the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2621 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Williamson moves House Bill 2621 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Are there any objections? Seeing none, so ordered. Who would like to carry the bill? Representative Williamson will be the carrier. Thank you, committee. We're adjourned.
Wow.
Thank you, committee. We're adjourned.
Wow.